Well, good morning. It is good to be back. I've been gone the last 2 weeks, the last 2 Sundays I've been in Albania, and I want to thank Andrew for filling in for me. Wonderful job, as always. And I tell you, it is nice to be back and to be able to see, I love being gone and I love the trip, but it's also very nice to come back and to see a congregation full of familiar faces that I know and love very much, and I'm so thankful for this church. I've actually been in a very good mood lately. So while we were in Albania, we were at a camp. And if you've ever been to a church camp, it's a wonderful experience. You wake up and there's devotionals every morning. There's prayers throughout the day. It's like a spiritual focus in everything you do. Every night there's a worship service. There's Bible classes. And it's something about the combination of spending an entire week in the outdoors, like with the rising and setting of the sun, setting your day, like that's good for the human body and for the soul. And then also spending it with a group of like-minded people, of friends, of people who have made a similar commitment to Christ, or children who are wanting to learn more about Christ. And then having that with the spiritual direction, it's just a reminder that there are very good things in this world, and God is still at work, and there are wonderful things taking place. There were baptisms there. Like, it's just been a wonderful, wonderful week of camp, and then coming home and seeing people that we know and love here. It has been a wonderful time getting back home and having worship, having Bible classes on Wednesday. But, you know, we've done other things also. It's kind of interesting. Yesterday was an interesting day because we had a birthday party in the morning and a birthday party in the evening, and we had a funeral and a memorial service right there in the middle of the day. And with all of those, though those are, you know, very different things, with every one of them, you could see the goodness and the beauty of God. You could see the goodness and the beauty of life. You see a child happy and celebrating and running and getting candy after a piñata. And it's like you see the joy of a life to be lived. But then also during the service for Chuck, you saw the beauty and meaning of a life well lived. And you saw the impact that he's had on so many people, and you saw how much love people had for him. And one of the things that is encouraging about, whether you're talking about camp, whether you're talking about children celebrating a birthday party, whether you're talking about a service in memory of a life lived in honor and a life lived in love and in faithfulness to Christ, is that in every one of those, you see the goodness of God, and you see the power of Jesus, and you see hope for something greater. And I actually think that those are all keys to what we're going to be talking about this morning. We're talking about the first sign in the Gospel of John, which is where Jesus turned water into wine. And there's a lot that can be said about this, the sign of Jesus. There's a lot that can be said about the meaning of it and the significance of it. But I think if you were just to boil it down, I think the basic idea is that with Jesus, there are good things to come. With Jesus, things are meaningful and good and beautiful. With Jesus, there is joy. Even when it seems like things are going to be a problem, even when it seems like things are going awry, when you set your heart and your focus and your mind on Jesus, things turn out. There is hope for the future. There is resurrection. There is hope of eternal glory. There is the ultimate victory of God that we get to participate in. And that's seen in a small way, but in a powerful sign, when Jesus is at a wedding feast in Cana of Galilee. So if you have your Bibles, turn to John chapter 2, and that's where we're going to be in our lesson this morning. John chapter 2, and we're going to see Jesus demonstrate the goodness and the joy of God at a wedding feast. Now, as we talk about this text, I think there are a couple of important things to note just based on where it is and the way that it's introduced to us. Two phrases in particular are in this story. In the very first verse of it, John chapter 2 and verse 1, it is introduced as, "On the third day, there was a wedding in Cana of Galilee, and the mother of Jesus was there." But then the final verse of it, in verse 11, It says, this beginning of his signs Jesus did in Cana of Galilee. So notice the repetition of the phrase Cana of Galilee in both the beginning and the end. That's kind of like a bracket for this story. And what we're seeing is Jesus arrived, but he did it on the third day. I don't think that's an insignificant detail. You're not often told exactly which day it was that Jesus was doing things. And by the way, we're not really even specifically told on the third day from what. If you've been reading John up to this point, he'll be saying things like, and on the next day, and on the next day. And if you count those up, this doesn't seem like it should be the third day. So what is it the third day from? I don't exactly know. But I think the key is to know that it's the third day. Because I believe that this story, which is the beginning of his signs, is meant to mirror the conclusion of his signs, which also happened on the third day. When you get to the end of the Gospel of John, the greatest sign that Jesus performs, the one to which all others have been pointing, is his resurrection from the dead on the third day. And in this sign, you look and you see that there's a wedding that people are supposed to be enjoying, but it looks like something awful has happened. There was a blunder, a faux pas. There was a mistake that was made in calculating how much wine there would be that was necessary to satisfy all of the guests. And they've run out, and they've run out early. In wedding feasts in those days, it wasn't just like a two-hour event. This was a multi-day event. And this would be something that would be a shame and an embarrassment on the family that was throwing the wedding. But then also, in particular, there's a church person that the family would choose who was supposed to ensure that everything went smoothly for the wedding. Sometimes he's called like the master of the feast or the master of the ceremony. For him, this is a catastrophic blunder. And so it looks like things have gone dire and the party's going to be over. But then with Jesus, you realize the party's not over. Jesus turns the party into something that's even greater than you could have imagined, even better than it was, even better than they planned on it being. I think when you get to the end of the Gospel of John, you're going to see that same pattern where you see Jesus taken and mocked and beaten and arrested, and you see him nailed to a cross, and you start thinking, the party's over. The ministry is coming to a conclusion. The healings that he's done, the signs he's been performing, the great teaching, it's all coming to an end because the power of the Roman Empire, the power of the forces of darkness and Satan himself have gathered together to eliminate what Jesus is doing and to put an end to it. But on the third day, you come to find out that the party's just getting started. The party is not over. Jesus is going to do something greater than anyone could have ever possibly expected. Jesus is going to perform the greatest sign that gives hope that the party's not over, but in fact that the very thing that you thought might destroy it, the very death itself that destroys everything that we have hopes and plans of, is defeated in Christ, and there is hope for something greater. I think these two signs are meant to mirror each other. In fact, the fact that Jesus' sign, as it says right there, this beginning of his signs that he performed in Cana of Galilee, John records a series of signs throughout the book, and he tells us at the end of it that the purpose of these have been carefully chosen and selected to produce faith in the one who reads them. So like the purpose of these signs is to produce faith. If you're thinking about what's the first sign you're going to choose, it is interesting that the first one he mentions is the water into wine. I think that is supposed to calibrate our thinking for the rest of the signs that we see. I think it introduces us to what Jesus is doing so that we can see this same idea reflected in each of his additional signs. So, for example, the next sign he does is he heals a nobleman's son, also in Cana of Galilee. What you have there is someone whose son is sick at the point of death, and he's terrified, and he's a father who is without the ability to save his own child, which is a terrible feeling. And yet, the party's not over. Jesus brings the good wine to that situation. Jesus brings something, a blessing to that situation, and he brings about great healing. You have a man at a pool of Bethesda, and he's been waiting year after year to be put into the water because he thinks that's going to be a source of healing and joy and salvation. But you come to find out that it's not actually found in the water. It's found in Jesus, by the way. I think that's kind of a similar point to this water into wine thing. But as you go through and you look at each of these signs, you come to find out that Jesus is bringing blessing to all of these situations. And it will culminate, in, again, on the third day, just like the wedding was on the third day, Jesus' resurrection is on the third day, him bringing hope to every situation. And so this introduction to the signs of Jesus, I think, is very, very appropriate for everything that's going to follow in the Gospel of John, and it's very appropriate for how we ought to be thinking about what God is doing in the world around us. It is also important that this is not simply a miracle. The word miracle, it's really, I mean, that's an English word, and the words that are used in Greek to describe miracle don't actually usually mean the exact same thing that we mean when we say miracle, because those same words are used to describe things that are not miracles. So sometimes it's the word like that's usually translated as something like wonder. Sometimes it's the word translated as something like power. And sometimes it's translated as something like sign. And all of those things, there can be wonders that are either supernatural or not. And there could be powerful things that are either supernatural or not. And there could be signs that are either supernatural or not. And so I think it's noteworthy that the word that John chooses over and over again is the word sign. Because a sign is not just a miracle. It is a demonstration that points to something beyond itself. And that's something that Jesus does all throughout the Gospel of John, in his teaching and in his miracles or signs. When Jesus performs a sign, you are not just supposed to look at that sign as though that's the destination. That sign is pointing you to something else. If you're trying to go to Dollywood and you see a sign that says, Dollywood, this exit, that sign is not the destination. That's telling you what direction to go to find Dollywood. Dollywood is the destination, right? These signs that Jesus performs, if you simply take the sign, you're going to miss the point. You have to try to find out what is the sign pointing you towards. The same thing is true in Jesus' teaching. When he tells Nicodemus, a man needs to be born again. You know, Nicodemus is thinking, birth, okay? That's something that a mother, you know, gives to a child. How is this man going to be born a second time and go into his mother's womb? He is hearing the physical teaching of Jesus, but missing the spiritual meaning. When Jesus is at the well with the woman at the well, and he says, if you had asked, I would give you living water that would become a spring within you, producing everlasting life. And she says, but you don't even have a bucket, and the well is deep. How are you going to get this water? She's thinking very physically about a well and a bucket, rather than the actual spiritual deeper meaning that Jesus is trying to give. Jesus tells his disciples after Lazarus dies, Lazarus has fallen asleep, but I will wake him. And they say to him, no, if he's asleep, let him rest. He'll get better. You know, the man's sick. Let him have his nap. And Jesus is saying, no, I'm talking about something deeper than that. This happens over and over again. Virtually every conversation Jesus has, he says something physical with a deeper spiritual meaning. Every sign that he performs, he does something physical with a deeper spiritual meaning. When he feeds the 5,000 the bread, and they say, that was awesome. More bread, please. Jesus eventually has to say, no, I am the bread. Like, I'm the bread that comes down out of heaven and gives you life. Like, he's trying to give a spiritual meaning to it. So if we read this, if we read the story of Jesus turning water into wine, and we focus only on the wine or on the wedding, then I think we're missing what it's actually pointing to. One of the great tragedies of this text is that it has become a central part of a modern debate in churches about alcohol. And the purpose of this lesson has nothing to do with alcohol or anything like that. So, like, if you read Jesus turning water into wine, and you say, okay, that's wonderful, what's the alcohol content? I think you're doing the same thing that Nicodemus is doing when he says, wait a minute, but how do you enter a second time into your mother's womb? Or that the woman at the well is doing when she says, but the well is deep, how are you going to get it? I think you're missing the point to focus on like the physical symbol rather than the actual deeper meaning of it. I know when it comes to alcohol, there's going to be a wide variety of experiences and views towards it. That is not the point of this passage right here. The point of this passage is that Jesus has brought about great blessing in a dire situation to show that the age of the Messiah has come and God's goodness is going to be poured out on his people. That is a much better meaning for this particular sign than to get into an argument about, you know, something like wine or whatever. And so keep that in mind as we go throughout, because I think the way that the story is structured, we'll be able to see the outpouring of God's goodness on his people. So here's basically how the story goes. Jesus is at a wedding. John chapter 2 and verse 1. On the third day, there was a wedding in Cana of Galilee, and the mother of Jesus was there. And both Jesus and his disciples were invited to the wedding. Verse 3. When the wine ran out, the mother of Jesus said, "They have no wine." And Jesus said to her, "Woman, what does that have to do with us? My hour is not yet come." And his mother said to the servants, "Whatever he says to you, do it." And so Jesus, I think, demonstrates some apprehension at this point, but Mary trusts in what he's going to do and says, "Whatever he says to you, go ahead and do it." And so she's really the one who gets the ball rolling here at this wedding feast. So here's what Jesus says to do in verse 6. Now there were 6 stone water pots set there for Jewish custom of purification, containing 20 or 30 gallons each. And Jesus said to them, "Fill the water pots with water." So they filled them to the brim. And he said to them, "Draw out some now and take it to the head waiter," or to the master of the ceremony, the master of the feast, the guy who's in charge, chosen by the family to make sure everything runs smoothly. And so they bring it to him, and he tastes it. Now notice verse 9. When the head waiter tasted the water, which had become wine, and he did not know where it came from, but the servants who had drawn the water knew, the head waiter called to the bridegroom. And he said to him, "Every man serves the good wine first, but then after the people have drunk freely, then he serves the poorer wine. But you have kept the good wine until now." And that little statement about the reversal of the normal custom at a wedding is where the story ends. Like, that's the last thing we hear about what happens there. Just, there's this statement, wait a minute. Normally things start off with the best wine and it gets worse as it goes on, but you have reversed it, where you started with the worst and things got better as it went on. And then that's the end. And then John comes in, the narrator, and he tells us in verse 11, that this beginning of his signs Jesus did in Cana of Galilee and manifested his glory, and the disciples believed in him. One of the reasons that we had the scripture reading that we had a moment ago is because Jesus is introduced as demonstrating the very glory of God in the Gospel of John. It says the Word, Christ, he became flesh and he tabernacled among us and we beheld his glory. Glory as of the only begotten of the Father. Each of these signs is going to be producing and demonstrating a glimpse of the glory of God throughout. And so after this demonstration of God's glory, the disciples come to believe as they see what Jesus has done. So what does all of this mean? We've said there's a deeper meaning to it than simply the wedding got better. I think there's something deeper here and something profound and something that we should learn a lot from. As a backdrop to it, I think it's important to know that wine is an important image of God's blessing in the Messianic age. What I mean is when you read through the Old Testament, and I won't even limit it to wine. I think it's true of vineyards and grapes and the liquid that is produced from them. The vineyard is something that when God is picturing how good the promised land is, the children of Israel are going to receive, what's the picture? It's like you have two people carrying the grapes. There's so many that they like, it takes two men to carry a cluster of grapes. When you read through like Isaiah 25, you get this picture of the new and glorious age that is coming. And the picture of that is a feast with good wine there. In Amos chapter 9, when describing that glorious future age, it says that there will be wine, so many grapes on the mountains and the wine will come. And in Joel chapter 2, the blessing, the promise of God's restoration and blessing for his people is that the vats will flow with wine and new wine. Like over and over again, the grape, the vineyard, a bountiful harvest, all of these things are pictures of God's goodness. In fact, Israel itself is pictured as God's vineyard. In Isaiah 5, there's this powerful parable that's given where God has done all of this work to turn this field that had, like, it had unproductive ground. There's no way you could make a vineyard in it. He prepares the soil. He builds a tower. He irrigates it. He does everything that's needed to make this a beautiful field for a good, productive vineyard. And then he starts growing the grapes on it. But then when he comes to check on them, the grapes, which should have been good, have become sour. They have not produced what they should have. And that's his picture of what Israel has become. Israel was this vineyard of God, but they have not become what God wanted them to be. They've become sour grapes. Instead of righteousness and justice, there's been bloodshed and a cry of distress. Like, they're producing the wrong fruit. But the fruit they should produce is the good grape. That's why I think Jesus is hinting at that idea in John 15. By the way, right here you have Jesus turning water into wine. In John 15, his final I am statement, he says, I am the vine. You know, it's like, I am the true vine. The idea of the grape is going to be here from beginning to end. And what you see in John 15 is like, life with God is found through being connected to the vine and being the fruit of the grape that's produced on it. It's like, it's a constant positive image in the Bible when God is giving his people grapes, when God is giving his people wine, when God is giving his people vineyards. When they enter into the land, the promised land, there are all of these blessings and curses associated with life in the land. And the blessings that you see is productive vineyards. And one of the curses that you see is that there are no grapes. And so you see that idea a lot. And so that, I think, has to be in our minds as we get to this text and see what Jesus is doing. Something else that should be in our mind is that with Jesus, we should not expect the ordinary. So the ordinary custom is you give the poor wine or the good wine at first, and then it gets poorer as the ceremony goes on. But what Jesus does is he reverses that norm. I think that's key to understanding this text. In fact, whenever I do read this text, I always have that song in my head. The best is yet to come, and babe, won't it be fun? But I'm not going to sing. I asked Lauren, hey, can I sing that whole song up there? And she said, don't do that. But that song is like, because I think that's, again, I think you're getting to the point of it. Jesus fills the Jewish water pots for purification with water. But prior to coming to Jesus, the ritualistic purifying water and stuff, it's just water. Don't get me wrong. I like water. I drink a lot of water. Water's way more of a part of my diet than wine is. Like water is something that I think is good, and we should all drink water. There's nothing wrong with water. But water's not usually the cause for celebration. Water's not usually what you bring out to make a wedding feast better. I don't think it's an accidental detail that we're told in verse 6 that these water pots were for the custom of purification. Jesus actually has quite a few controversies about some of the purifying customs of Israel and what he is bringing and the cleansing that he is bringing. And I think what you have here is prior to Jesus, you have the water. That satisfies what you need, right? But once it comes to Jesus, it becomes something so much better. There's true joy found in it. There's cause for celebration once it comes to Jesus. And I think that is also one of the key ideas here. In essence, Jesus makes everything better. You can talk about I started off this lesson talking about some of the good things that have been happening. Even things that might seem dark and dreary and sorrowful, with Christ, we know that those aren't the end of the story. Which is why this parable has to be read as mirroring what you have there at the end of the gospel with the resurrection of Jesus. At the cross, it seemed like the party was over. But in the resurrection, there is hope and joy for eternity. When the wine ran out, it seemed like the party was over. But with Jesus, there was hope and joy for the celebration to go on. This beginning of his signs, Jesus did at Cana of Galilee, and he manifested his glory, and the disciples believed in him. That is how John wants us to conclude the story thinking about it. This is the beginning of his signs, and it should be our guide for how we view all that Jesus does from this point forward. He is going to take things, and he's going to turn them into something great. He's going to give an abundant life. He's going to make it reason for celebration. And this is actually a manifestation of God's glory. Now, that's pretty incredible. If you were to ask, how is it that you should see God's glory? I don't know what answers you might want to give. Maybe you would say something like, you spend a lot of time in prayer and Bible study, and maybe you could see the glory of God and some of the things that he has done. Or maybe time in fellowship with other people. Like, there's a lot of ways I think you could perhaps consider seeing God's glory. But one of the most interesting images of this is what you see when you look at God's glory is a wedding where water becomes wine. It's like when you think about that event happening and when you contemplate it and spend some time chewing on it and thinking about it, you're actually experiencing and witnessing the glory of God, the fame of God, that which makes God worthy of praise and honor and worship in this moment. Again, it's more than just a wedding got saved. That is the basic physical meaning of what took place. And I think that's important, by the way. I think Jesus does care about people. I think he wants to help, a family who's about to be embarrassed. If he can help them out of that, that's a good thing to do. And he does that. But it also demonstrates something, I think, profoundly deeper. That with the coming of Jesus, we have an age to rejoice, an age to celebrate. We have an age of good things. And that is actually a depiction of the very glory of God filling our world with the coming of Jesus. And it was that depiction that was manifest that caused his disciples to believe in him. That's actually something that you'll see over and over again throughout John, even at the resurrection, by the way, when Peter and James go to the empty tomb. Peter and John go to the empty tomb, and it says they look inside it. It says, and they believed in him. Like, a lot of times after these signs, you're going to have a statement that they believed in him after it. So they do believe in him here, but I don't know if they have the full belief that they will eventually receive as each of these puzzle pieces is put together in the life and ministry of Jesus. But this was enough to cause them to begin to see him in a new way. And I think and I hope and I pray that it should cause us to see him in a new way also. So as we bring the lesson to a close, I want us to remember there is the goodness of God still at work in our world. And sometimes it may seem like the party's about to be over and the joy has run out. That's when you look to Jesus in trust. That's when you try to turn things over to Jesus. That's when you try to remember what Jesus has done and is still doing in the world. I think the mission trips that that I know a number of people have been on this summer, those are a good way to get a good reminder. Sometimes we can get so used to the ordinary routine of life that we forget to see it. But when there's a VBS here at church, really pay attention to that and think there are people at work for the sake of the kingdom that are doing good things. And children are growing in joy and they're growing in their knowledge of Christ. When you see the people becoming members here at church, when you see people who have studied and prepared Bible classes and are teaching them and are engaging in the public teaching ministry of the church that started with Jesus and has continued every week since that time, like, that's a beautiful thing. That's a good thing that's happening. That's not something to just kind of take for granted and forget about and ignore and assume it's just part of the normal custom of life. Recognize that there's goodness and there's beauty in so many things around us. Sometimes being kind of jolted out of your normal routine can help with that. As we bring our lesson to a close, let us be the people who see that beauty in the world around us. Let us be the people who diligently recognize the good that God is doing. Let's be people of joy, hope, and faith in the glorious age of Jesus Christ. When you read about Jesus turning water into wine, you shouldn't ask all the questions about the wine that maybe we want to ask. What we should see is that Jesus, just like he's the bread of life, he is that new wine that saves the party. The messianic age is that new wine that saves the party. The goodness of his salvation and joy, the hope of resurrection, that God can turn disaster into celebration. Like, That's the goodness of his glory that we should be seeing in the world around us and trying to promote and trying to talk about and being people of joy. And so try to remember that. I challenge you to try to be people of joy this week as you consider the good that is happening in the world around us and the work that God is doing. And one way, by the way, that I want to encourage you to do that is also next week. Next week, we are going to be having our Missions Sunday. And so we're going to have different speakers talking about different things that we've been engaged in as a congregation and different different mission points that we've been working with throughout the world. And I want to encourage you to come here to try to learn more about that, to celebrate the goodness of God that is taking place in the mission efforts of this congregation, and to find more ways that you can contribute and join and help and share in that as well. But if there's anyone here this morning, when you're looking at your life and your walk with Christ, and you're seeing that there's no reason to celebrate, Jesus can change that. He can forgive you of your sins. You can name him Lord of your life. You can have your sins washed away in baptism. If you're a Christian who's struggling and you need encouragement, you need celebration of Christ in your life, let that be known. We could pray for you. We could help encourage and strengthen you in any way that we can. If you want to talk to one of our elders in the library in the back, please do that. Or you can come and sit on the front row while we stand and as we sing.